Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the book of Genesis. We're currently in Genesis chapter 21, a narrative about Abraham and Isaac and Sarah and Hagar. A very, very difficult experience in the life of the two parents and Hagar and Ishmael. As we have said, the narrative is really about the actions and the character of God. God is always the protagonist. People are just players, interactors in all of that, and we must remember that. Now, for a little context, in case you missed the last program, Abraham and Sarah, not wickedly, but in their weakness, in fear, as we are prone to do as believers, had tried to jerry-rig God's promises. God had promised to give them an heir, and okay, they believed God in that, but then they started thinking, well, maybe there's something we need to do to make that happen. And so what they did was take Hagar, Abraham's concubine, and give her to Abraham to impregnate her and to get a son, and that son was Ishmael, and problem solved. No, it was not God's plan. And therefore, the Lord has to work his plan in spite of what they did, and choices have consequences. And here that consequence is coming to fruition. Isaac has just been weaned. There's a big celebration. Ishmael is about now 13 years old. And Hagar and Ishmael are no longer in front row seats in the family. And that's not sitting well with anybody. So at this feast, when Isaac is weaned, Sarah spots Ishmael, a 13-year-old, mocking her probably 3-year-old son. And that just splits her britches, as we often say. And she's not going to have any of that. Probably there were some antecedents, some precursors leading up to this. And now she is furious. And she says to Abraham, that lady's got to go. The kid's got to go. Get him out of our house. They're not going to be heirs with my son. Now, that kind of brings us up to speed. So let's try to connect in with what we were last saying. I was pointing out that was a day when a godly wife was expected to address her husband in very respectful tones, and that meant in the day calling him Lord. We learned that from 1 Peter. Sarah was one of those women, but still there are times, I noted, when husbands are not inclined for some reason to listen to their exasperated wives. And yet it could be that the wives are right, even if they are emotionally bent out of shape to the point that they're not being very persuasive or maybe even respectful, because Sarah here, she is freaked out. And she is very demanding. She's out of square with the customs of the time and out of square with the customs of God with regard to a wife's relationship to her husband. Fortunately, Abraham was a man of God, a friend of God, and a man that had a good head on his shoulders and was very wise. And in spite of the fact this caused him enormous pain, the Lord said to him, despite his agony in verse 12, "Do not be distressed about the boy and Hagar." Easy for God to say, right? Listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac, not Ishmael, that your offspring will be reckoned. To ease somewhat all that emotional distress that Abraham was feeling by having seen Hagar and Ishmael packing to leave, with spare provision for very harsh conditions. God now intervenes with a renewed promise that despite the threat Abraham saw to the survival of his concubine and his true son, Ishmael, God says, Abraham, I will make the son of the slave into a nation also. And I'll do it just because I'm blessing you, because he is your offspring. Rest assured, the Lord is telling them, they will be safe. I will see to it. For your sake, I will multiply this son of yours into a nation. You're not sending them to their death in a harsh desert. He's not going to be a cast off. He's not going to die in the wilderness. I'm assuring you of that. So grab your faith by its bootstraps and trust me, don't fear. Ishmael has a great future ahead of him. So for Abraham's sake, who greatly loved Ishmael, God promises Abraham that Ishmael's line would multiply. He would live, and he would live large. And that was a big thing back in the day. Ishmael was not one of God's elect, but he was favored with a multitude of progeny. As God told Moses in Exodus, as sovereign creator, and given mankind's natural state of sinfulness and rebellion toward God, God does reserve the right and in all justice to show mercy to whom he pleases, to show compassion upon whom he desires. That is entirely God's prerogative. Nobody has a call on it on the basis of merit. That includes not only nations but individuals. And given human beings innate aversion to the living and the true God, nobody can justly complain of divine mistreatment. Well, in verse 14, we cannot imagine what a hard step of faith it must have been. Early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of water, perhaps about 3 liters. He gave them to Hagar. Gosh, this must have been painful. He set those water skins on her shoulders and sent her packing off with the boy, who was 13, 14 about this time. And there Hagar went on her way, all alone with a boy who was barely a teenager, wandering in the desert of Beersheba, apparently southeast in the direction of northern Arabia. For Abraham, that was a pitiful sight, to be sure. But in the plan and grace of God, this will turn out all right for Hagar and Ishmael. But the two of them at the time could not see that. And Abraham could only see it through the eyes of God's promise. And right there, folks, is a snapshot of the life of faith. In the beginning, whatever God providentially ordains for us in our path, it may be hard. In the middle of it, it may be harsh. But in the end, it will be happy landings for those who walk by faith. The faith in this case was Abraham's. And from verse 18, we take it, by inference, that it became the faith of Hagar as well, her faith in God's promise. In our walk of faith, as any veteran believer has learned, sometimes when it comes to the fulfillment of God's promises, things seem to go bad before they get better. That stress, however, just strengthens our faith in God's Word. When we've been through those cycles a few times, and I've lived long enough to go through those cycles many times. I once had a little game with our girls that I've often shared from the pulpit. I was in my first pastorate. This one, up to this point, 29 years, is only my second in between was academic ministry. But in that first pastorate, I had a schedule, and I would regularly, about 9:15, walk up to the parsonage, which was within walking distance, to go visit Aussie and share with her my morning, which started at 7 o'clock, and also to have a little fun, a little time with my girls for half hour or so. They were just little tykes. I would say the situation I'm about to describe was probably 4 and 2. And we had in the parsonage a movable dishwasher. It's on wheels. So I would adjust it, and I would stand there in the kitchen. Aussie was often doing things in the kitchen. And the girls were around me, tugging on my leg, doing whatever. And I thought, well, I'll just have a little fun with them. So I would place them one at a time up on the dishwasher, And then I'd step back a little and I'd ask them to jump. And I remember Christy would say, "Oh, Daddy." And I'd say, "Go ahead, honey. Daddy will catch you. Daddy, go ahead. I promise you, you'll not fall. I'll catch you." That's just like God in the circumstances of life. He promises to care for us. He promises to take care of us. So she would jump, and I'd set her down on the floor, and she'd go, "Ooh, I want to do that again." Up she would go, and we'd go through the same thing a time or two. Well, that got a little boring, and then I would step back again. Ooh. This was a challenge to her faith in her daddy, her father. So again, we'd go through that, and then it would be Julie. "Daddy, that's too far. Come on. Come on, honey. Daddy will catch you." Well, you get the picture. I don't need to draw it out. And that's the way it is in our Christian life. God is always stretching our faith, and he's stretching Abraham's here. Well, in verse 15 to Hagar, it's all going downhill fast. She was not given enough provisions in the first place to take her and her son to a safe place or to an oasis somewhere. What she had with her was all that she could manage. Now, you might wonder, certainly it's natural to wonder, why a rich man like Abraham didn't just arrange for her journey an escort with ample provisions to take her to some safe place. Now, as my wife and some others well know, when it comes to biblical things, I'm not one given to speculation. As a rule, I generally find it unhelpful and sometimes can be very misleading. People are always writing on biblical themes that are rich in speculation, and to them, I say, get over it, stop it. My best guess, and it's only a guess, is that Abraham took the Lord at his word. When God told Abraham back in verse 13, "Abraham, don't worry, don't sweat it, don't be eaten up with fear. I'm going to make a vast nation of Ishmael." So given God's orders to dismiss the two, Abraham, I take it, felt somehow God would cause them to land on their feet as promised. What we do know is that his hesitation to send them a well-provisioned escort had nothing to do with callousness. Saw that back in verse 11. It tore his heart out. Well, we read that when the water in the skin was gone, she sheltered the boy under one of the bushes, most likely a tamarisk tree, which thrives in arid regions. Its leafy branches would have provided, we are told, welcome shade. Well, this is really a poignant and heart-wrenching scene. Dreading the agony of watching Ishmael die of dehydration. We read in verse 16, oh man, talk about ripping the heart out of a mother. She went off and sat down about a bow shot away. She was thinking, I cannot watch the boy die. As she sat there, understandably, she began to cry. From here, we can see the tears streaming down her heartbroken face. What a wrenching scene that must have been. Any parent, especially a mother, can only imagine how terrible that feeling must have been. Well, I always say, God seldom saves the bacon until it's crisp. No cry of the afflicted is beyond his hearing. Verse 17, it's no surprise. God heard the boy crying. Was that cry a prayer, as many take it? We don't know. But we do read that the angel of the Lord responded. He called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What is the matter, Hagar?" Well, he knew what was the matter. It was just when somebody says that, they're telling you that comfort, relief is on the way. Do not be afraid. God has heard the boy crying as he lies there. Hagar, verse 18, "Lift the boy up, take him by the hand." And then here is a huge promise. "I will make him into a great nation." Folks, God is always attentive to the cries of those upon whom his favor rests. He may not answer our cries when we want. He may not answer them how we prefer. But his answer to our cries will always be better than what we wanted, but in his own time. Because of Abraham, God's favor rested upon Hagar and Ishmael. He made a promise to Abraham, and God shows himself faithful in keeping it. Now listen to me for a minute. Many persons or groups or tribes or nations or armies or businesses or other institutions or entities simply have no idea that, as in the case of God, God's favor for a time or in a situation rests upon them, yes, them, because of one or some of God's people among them whom God is blessing. Think of Noah and his sons that spared the world for 120 years until finally God's patience was exhausted. Think of Abraham's rescue of Lot. Think of the house of Potiphar because of Joseph. Think of the jailer because of Joseph. Think of the Magi in Babylon being saved because of Daniel and his three friends. Who knows how many are being blessed or spared in some way or other simply because of God's people among them. And this is one of those instances. The interrogative in such situations, what's the matter, Hagar, is, as I said, a way of announcing that there is really no cause for concern, but help is on the way. It's a way of saying the Lord has it handled. Hagar can resume her motherly care, for God is, he promises, going to provide for them. God is going to protect the two of them, and God is going to cause her son, when he matures, to produce a great nation. You notice here that phrase, the angel of the Lord called to her. That appears to be an appearance of the pre-incarnate Christ, not just an ordinary generic angel. Why do I say that? Well, note that the angel makes his promise in the first person. I will make him into a great nation. Well, that is God's work, not a mere angel's work. Well, in verse 19, the rescue of Hagar and Ishmael begins immediately. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. So she went and filled the skin with water and gave the thirsty boy a drink. I don't get the impression that God miraculously created that well where before there was none. My impression is that the supernatural element here seems more likely to have been opening her eyes to see a source of water that in her distress she had not seen before, and in fact, in her exhaustion, had given up on finding. Now, it could have been either way. But if the latter, the narrative illustrates an important way that God comes to our rescue, folks. Hagar is us. Sometimes it is just opening our eyes. Sometimes it's just God guiding us into solutions that were there all along, but we did not see them. You see, with God, to use an old cliche, there's more than one way to skin a cat. It is not always putting what we need in our hands. Sometimes it may be just opening our eyes to resources that we have not seen or thought of. It's kind of like Samuel running through the sons of Jesse, trying to find the king, and had run through the whole family, and he thought all of his hope was exhausted. But actually, God had out in the field Jesse's youngest son, David. True to his word, as always, God was with the boy as he grew up, verse 20. That does not mean the boy Ishmael was with God. Rather, it means that God was with him. That's because God is as good as his word to Abraham and to Hagar. Well, we read that Ishmael lived in the desert, and he became an archer. That occupation suggests that he became a fine hunter, or perhaps a fearsome warrior, or both. While he was living in the desert of Paran, verse 21, northern Sinai Peninsula, we read, it kind of catches our attention, that his mother got a wife for him from Egypt, his own country of origin. Now, this suggests that Hagar was a pretty resourceful woman to accomplish something that normally would have been a father's assignment to bring off. I suggest that Hagar was a remarkable lady in her own right. Well, in verse 22, Abimelech, as I've mentioned, like Pharaoh, appears to be a dynastic title, not a personal name. The same may be true of Philco. We read, We're not now talking about the Hagar narrative. That is finished. Now, it came about at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of the army, spoke to Abraham and said something we notice: God is with you in all that you do. So they said to Abraham, "Therefore swear to me here by God that you will not deal falsely with me or with my offspring or with my posterity, but deal with me according to the kindness that I've shown to you, Abraham, and you shall show to me in the land in which you have sojourned." And Abraham said, "I swear it." So the narrative turns a page. Here is a great testimony of God's faithfulness to Abraham. His high-level Gentile neighbors notice, and they are so impressed that they feel as sound political policy. They need to establish peaceful relations with a man in such good standing with his God. They felt that Abraham was not a person they wanted to get on the wrong side of. That's an illustration of the Lord making a believer's enemies to be at peace with him. True, verse 23, Abimelech had treated Abraham well. Now he asked Abraham to make a formal treaty with him to reciprocate. Verse 24, godly man that Abraham was, he readily obliged, for he was a man of God, a man of peace. Water in that arid world, then and now, has always been a precious resource, and most especially for one like Abraham, whose wealth was measured mainly in livestock. Wells were gold. Frequently, the source of frictions and fightings over water rights were common. Apparently, some of Abimelech's servants had misappropriated one of Abraham's wells. We assume, but cannot know for sure, that on this occasion, when Abimelech thought it was in his best interest to keep good relations to Abraham, perhaps prompted by a recent dust-up of this incident by which Abraham lodges his complaint to Abimelech, Abraham broaches the subject of the infringement. Well, Abimelech certainly would not have infringed on Abraham had he not felt that Abraham was pretty equal terms with him in power. The narrative bears out, and this is all about God, the narrative bears out the growing stature of Abraham. Though he's an alien in the land, God's blessing is upon him. And so, Abimelech professes no previous knowledge of the bad behavior of his servants, implies that he would not have tolerated had he known it. On the other hand, he may have heard of it, but fear of retaliation might have been what prompted Abimelech to make a hasty treaty with Abraham. So Abraham, a man of peace, initiates a treaty ceremony, which he has to explain to Abimelech the meaning of. Ceremonial acceptance of those seven lambs, Abraham explained, was a witness that Abraham was owner of the disputed well, for his servants had dug it themselves. So in verse 31, they both swore an oath there. They named it Beersheba. It means a well of seven, or well of the oath. But we learn the origin of that famous name in Old Testament history. So in verse 32, all the parties depart amicably after the sealing of the treaty by oath taking. Abimelech returns to the land of the Philistines. They had not at this point in time become the hostile nation they would later become in the era of the Judges. So in an act of worshipful celebration of God's care and protection, Abraham planted as a memorial at the moment a tamarisk tree, and he called upon the name of the Lord under the title of Elomon, or Eternal God. He settled down there in Philistine territory under the shelter of God's protection for a long time. Well, thank you, dear friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.